It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report finds reduced voter turnout in Milwaukee's elections this year because of limited polling stations and African-American voters were disproportionately impacted. First, ice cream and summer go hand in hand. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we wanted to talk about some ice cream projects at home. But making ice cream, while fun, usually requires a special ice cream maker of some sort. Our next guest joins us to make the case that we can make great ice cream at home without fancy equipment. Maya Warren is an ice cream scientist and received her PhD in food science at UW-Madison. Maya, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Before we start making our own ice cream here, remind us what got you, Maya, into ice cream in particular.
So I've always just been that person that has loved ice cream as a kid. And everyone says that they love ice cream. And I love science too. And so I was like, and I was in high school, in college, I was like, how can I combine those two together to literally do what I love and love what I do every day? And the science of ice cream, it is, I guess. And I ended up, you know, going to Wisconsin-Madison and getting my PhD, you know, in Babcock Hall. That's where I was. And I just absolutely love anything and everything about ice cream. But the beauty of it is that, you know, it's pretty much speaks every language. You can find in every culture some type of frozen aerated dessert. And it always just makes people so happy. So I just love what ice cream does to people.
There's a lot of science, I know, that goes into the making of ice cream. What are a couple of the things we in the general public should know about some of the science of ice cream?
So the science of ice cream is so important because ice cream itself is actually made up of three different phases that you have to be able to get right in order to have the quality texture that you're looking for, and of course the taste that you're looking for. So ice cream itself is actually part solid. So, you know, we have the ice crystals and we have partially crystalline fat globules. And then we also have air cells. So there's actually quite a bit of air in ice cream. The measurement for that is called overrun. And it's so critical to have the right amount of overrun. You do not want to have too much overrun. Otherwise your ice cream will be super fluffy and super, super, super airy, which some people do like super fluffy ice cream, but other people kind of like a little bit more of a denser product. And then you also have part of the phase that is semi-liquid. We don't necessarily see that, but we, you know, look at that as like free water. And so all of those three things come together, combining together with, of course, the flavor and, you know, other ingredients to make that product that is so delicious, so creamy. And you want it to be able to have a long shelf life because you're not going to eat the whole tub of ice cream in one sitting. Well,
speak
most people
yourself.
Won't. Right? Most people won't. But it is just, the science of it is so incredibly intriguing. And because it's such a relatable science, kids are able to understand it, or, you know, 85, 90-year-olds are able to understand it. And it's just such a fun way to be able to teach science to kids and be able to have a ton of fun with it as well.
Well, let's get to the fun part now, making our own ice cream. And I'll say, I've always thought, Maya, that it'd be cool to make my own ice cream. But I know myself, if I went out and bought an ice cream maker, I'd use it a lot for 2-3 weeks. And then in 5 years, I'd find it tucked away in the basement again. I'm really excited about this no churn concept. What goes into making ice cream without the gear?
So without having to have an ice cream machine, we actually just need to be able to kind of dissect ice cream and then put it back together. So there's still key ingredients that are used in the no churn ice cream, just as you would use if you're using an ice cream machine. So you still need to have your sweetener source, or in this case, what I'm using often is sugar. So you still need that. You still need your milk fat source because, of course, ice cream has a legal definition in the United States where you have to have 10% or more milk fat. So you still have to bring that component of it in. You still need some water that comes in, and you need to be able to have a little bit of air in there so that when you scoop your ice cream, it's not literally an ice cube. And so there's still a balance. You still need to bring in something that can give you a bit of solid, some total solids, so that your product will freeze properly and you don't have too much water. And so there's still a balance. But the beauty of the no churn is that you literally, like, it's called no churn for a reason. You do not have to use an ice cream machine. You just need to be able to whip your heavy whipping cream to be able to have that stability that air cells will provide, as well as bring in that fat component. And if you do have an ice cream machine and you just want to try a no-churn recipe just for fun, it comes out wonderful. I mean, I've had so much fun with it during quarantine times, and people are making all kind of different flavors of ice cream. And I'm just like, whoa, I didn't know that people would fall in love with it so much.
Maya Warren is with us, ice cream scientist. It's Food Friday. She's telling us how to make ice cream even without an ice cream maker. You can join in, by the way, if you like to make your own ice cream or if you have questions about how to do it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Maya, you shared a few recipes with us. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's talk through, you know, one of the basic go-to flavors, your no-churn chocolate ice cream. Tell us about this and how we actually make it.
So the no-churn chocolate ice cream is absolutely delicious, especially if you are, you know, a huge chocolate fan. And it's so incredibly simple. Literally, all you need to do is take your heavy whipping cream, which I spoke about earlier, and to that you're going to add cocoa powder. But cocoa powder is quite bitter if you've had like 80% chocolate, you know, that has 80%. You know, it's quite bitter. So you need to be able to bring in a little bit of sugar with that. So add some cocoa powder, add sugar to your heavy whipping cream, and you're going to whip that with a hand mixer or a stand mixer till you get to a consistency where it's not chunky. It's pretty smooth, and it's kind of a little silky looking a little bit, but it's not wet. So there is definitely some science going in between when you're whipping it, and so I actually post videos to teach people how to whip the perfect whipped cream for making your no-churn ice cream, because you can over-whip it, which will create like a butter-type consistency, which you do not want chocolate butter ice cream. So, but when making the ice cream itself, you have the whipped cream, but then you're also going to add your sweetened condensed milk, your evaporated milk, and your little bit of sea salt and vanilla goes a long way in chocolate. And so you combine all of those together, and then you can get ready to layer in whatever it is that you want. So if you want like peanut butter in there, if you want Oreos or chocolate chips or caramel or nuts or cookie dough, like whatever it is, go ahead and layer that into your container that you're going to store it in. Put the lid on there, stick it in the freezer for about 5 to 6 hours, and voila, you have absolutely delicious no-churn chocolate ice cream that you made yourself.
That sounds so fantastic. I want to talk about some pratfalls we can hit, and let's start with the one you just mentioned, the risk of over-whipping the dairy. How do we know when it's right? Is it just a matter of feel?
It's a matter of feel and a matter of look. So you get to a certain point when you're whipping your whipped cream, when you're whipping your cream into whipped cream, where you start to really see it thicken, and it's still a little loose, but then you get to a point where it literally just looks like whipped cream. At that point, you pretty much want to stop. It's where it forms peaks. Those peaks are critical. You do not want it to be you want it to be stiff peaks, but you don't want them to be peaks that are so stiff that it looks like the whipped cream has sort of formed into clumps. You still want it to be smooth. So you want peaks, but you want them to be smooth, and you want it to have just a slight bit of shine to it, ever so slight. And that's literally the perfect whipped cream. And you mix that all in with your other ingredients, and I'm telling you, the ice cream is absolutely delicious.
What are the best ways to whip it? A hand mixer or what do you like to use?
I use a hand mixer, but I know there's a lot of bakers out there that might have stand mixers for various reasons. So a stand mixer also works very well. You can technically whip it with a whisk as well. So if you use any of those tools that are, you know, pretty standard in a home kitchen, you know, makes it easy to whip the cream. And that's one of the beauties of this no-churn ice cream, is that you do not have to have, you know, equipment that you may have to go out and really buy. There's usually something in the kitchen that you can use. And so I use a hand mixer, but I know people that have stand mixers, and I've also seen people whip it with just a whisk.
We're talking to Maya Warren, ice cream scientist. She received her PhD in food science, by the way, from UW-Madison. She is with us on this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about making no-churn ice cream at home. No special equipment purchases needed for the most part. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or have you ever made ice cream on your own with or without the special equipment? No churn or churn, either way. Tell us about your ice cream experiments, your favorite ways to make it, your favorite ways to eat it, and you might have questions for Maya as well along the way. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a few recipes, by the way. We'll get to another one or two at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about making ice cream at home without special equipment needed. Maya Warren is with us, ice cream scientist. She got her PhD in food science from UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you experimented with making ice cream with or without the special gear? Love to hear your story. What is your favorite flavor to make, favorite flavor to eat? Do you have a question? Does something go wrong for you? Maybe if you've been experimenting lately, call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Alec is with us in Madison. Alec, hi.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question is making ice cream using non-dairy milk, so using soy or coconut or almond milk. I wonder whether that's possible. Perhaps your guest can answer that one for me.
Alec, thanks for the call. I know on store shelves there are non-dairy ice cream products like that. What does it take to make something like that at home, Maya?
So, Alec, thank you so much for the question. And it's a very, very, very common question now, given the times that we are in terms of, you know, allergies and or just, you know, individuals wanting to cut out dairy and or animal products in general. And when it comes to making the non-dairy vegan ice cream products at home, one of the most important things is that you actually do need like a fat source. And so in the dairy ice cream, you have the milk fat coming in. But in the non-dairy, when you're looking at maybe using soy or maybe almond milk or oat milk or anything like that, you do not necessarily have fat coming in. You have a lot of a liquid that's very thin in viscosity. It has a lot of water in it. And with that, you somehow need to be able to bring in, again, some kind of fat source. So on the store shelves, there is coconut cream, canned coconut cream, and or canned coconut milk that you can use. Feel free to buy one of those. You want to put it in your refrigerator because you want that fat to harden. And when you have that fat that's hardened, that coconut milk fat, that coconut fat, you can then use that and you can whip that. You can add a sweetened condensed coconut milk to that you can make on the stove or you can buy it from the store. But not every coconut milk or coconut cream behave the same. So you definitely want to get ones like ones from 365, like Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or Thai Kitchen. There's a couple brands that really work in order to be able to make that product. And then there's also whipping cream that is a non-dairy whipping cream. There's one by Silk that I've seen that actually will whip that. Wow. You can then foam up into, you know, be able to have some mass to be able to make your no-churn vegan product. But you can also, you know, put the coconut cream into a ice cream machine as well. So there's definitely things that you can do with it, but you want to bring in the fat source in order to be able to bulk up and be able to have that smooth texture. And the beauty of coconut fat is that it mimics milk fat very, very well compared to fats that do not necessarily freeze because they're still liquid at the freezing temperature. So there's a lot of science that goes into that, but that's why sometimes on the store shelves, you'll have pints of ice cream or vegan products that are very, 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 very hard and icy. It's because the balance isn't there. So there are ways to get to the key balance.
All right. Hope that helps, Alec. Good luck. We'll go to Bowen now, calling from Madison. Bowen, hi.
Hi.
Hi. What did you want to ask about?
How many flavors are there of ice cream?
Wow, that's a huge question. How many flavors are there of ice cream, Maya? Has anybody managed to count them all?
There's so many, Bowen, that we can't even count them all. The beauty of ice cream is that it's a blank canvas. You can make any and every flavor that you want. So, Bowen, I've had ketchup ice cream. I've had chicken and waffle flavored ice cream, and I've had vanilla ice cream. So it literally spans the gamut. I've had tomato and basil flavored ice cream. I mean, literally, there's anything and everything. And all around the world, people eat ice cream or some version of frozen aerated desserts, and you can make it taste like anything you want. That's the beauty of it.
Fantastic, Bowen. Thanks so much for that question at 800-642-1234. Maya, I want to get into, speaking of, I think it's a non-dairy alternative, the world of sorbet. You've also shared with us a no-churn watermelon sorbet. Tell us about this dessert.
Yes, Rob, it is so incredibly delicious. So the beauty here is that you do not have to have an ice cream machine, and all you need to do is take some delicious watermelon, which of course, you know, it's fruit season right now. So watermelon or mango or strawberries or anything of that nature, and go ahead and cut it up, put it in the freezer for about 5 hours, or, you know, you can do it overnight, and then take your frozen chunks of watermelon, put them in a blender. I got to have a heavy duty blender or food processor of some sort. You don't want it to be a kind of a weak instrument, because you don't want to, you have frozen product that you're really trying to basically churn or kind of blend up, I should say. And you're going to literally pour some honey or kind of any alternative sweetener. So if you know, do not want to consume, added sugar, you can use honey or stevia, and you can even put in a little bit of lime juice or lemon juice, and you can even add some mint or basil or anything to it. Go ahead and blend that up in the blender, and you come out with a product that is so incredibly delicious, and it's a perfect texture to eat right away. But I've also had people freeze it in mason jars and pull it out later and have it for parties. And again, it is absolutely so refreshing, especially on these hot summer days. And you can even put them into like ice cube molds and put sticks in them and have them as like popsicle type desserts too. So it's vegan. It's super friendly in terms of, you know, allergies and things like that. So I definitely say go over there, give it a try. And for adults only, feel free to put alcohol in it too, because that really takes it up a notch.
We're talking to Maya Warren about making ice cream without fancy gear at home. That recipe she just mentioned for no churn watermelon sorbet is one of three she's shared with us. You can find them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go back to your calls now. Linda is on the line in Ladysmith. Linda, hello.
Hi. I'm just calling about frozen yogurt. Dairy ice cream doesn't agree with me, but I can eat frozen yogurt. So can you make some comments about that, please? Thank you.
Thanks for the call. So that would still be dairy, but cultured dairy for that frozen yogurt, Maya. How do we sort that out?
So we get a lot of questions on, you know, well, I'm, you know, either lactose intolerant or a maldigester of milk proteins, but I can eat some dairy products. And a lot of that has to do with the level, the percentage of what that item is that you might have an allergy to in another product, but you can eat something else. So if it is a milk protein or if it is lactose, it could be the level of it that it's at compared to the amount of, you know, the overall percentage of the composition compared to the amount of sugar and or, you know, non-fat dry milk or whatever else might be added to that. So a lot of that comes down to how much your body can actually tolerate. And it doesn't mean that you're not a maldigester or milk proteins or that you're not lactose intolerant. It just means that the level at which it is in that brand or that product, you can tolerate. And in ice cream, you may not be able to because of the levels.
I hope that helps, Linda. How about making our own froyo at home, frozen yogurt? Is that as easy or more difficult than making ice cream at home?
So, you know, I've actually never done it, but I actually think it would be pretty simple. You can take yogurt and add it to it. I made and I think I sent this one to you all, a no churn strawberry cheesecake ice cream, in which
right.
we added cream cheese to the base. So instead of adding cream cheese, we could actually add a Greek yogurt to the base to be able to get that, you know, yogurt taste in there, and then still add some of the cream. We have to still add cream in there in order to be able to get the right kind of texture and body, in order to be able to make it so that it's not too icy and you have, you know, it feels good when you put it in your mouth and it has the right delivery of taste and all of that. But I really think it could work. It's something I should definitely try.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Linda. I want to talk about one that is on your website. We don't have this one. It's at MayaWarren.com, your Dr. Maya website. This one just sounds so good to me. A no churn vanilla sea salt caramel ice cream. And I think there's a little bourbon snuck into this one. Can you tell
yes.
us about this combo and making your own caramel to go in it?
Yeah, so this one is absolutely, it's a win-win-win. I made it for last week on my Instagram, Ice Cream Sundays with Dr. Maya, where I was celebrating Father's Day. And I was like, you know, what's not a better combination than ice cream with a little bit of bourbon and some sea salt caramel? And so this one is so much fun. It takes the kind of the regular ice cream base that I've been making, but then to that, I'm adding some sea salt, and I'm also adding, you know, a couple of tablespoons of bourbon or dark liquor of someone's choice. And then you also have to bring in the caramel. So to make the caramel, it's super easy to make at home. Literally, you take sugar, butter, heavy whipping cream, some vanilla extract if you want, some more bourbon if you want, make it on the stove, and you can literally make caramel in a matter of about 10 minutes. It's super easy. And once you get that really nice amber color, you don't want to overcook it, because it's super easy to overcook the caramel, and it'll end up being very, very, very bitter. So you do not want it to get too dark. You want it to still be kind of a really nice color. And you add some sea salt to that, and you've got a beautiful decadent salted caramel that you can put in your refrigerator for, you know, a matter of, you know, a few weeks to a month, and you can still have a really nice caramel that you can use. And I basically made the ice cream base and then layered in that sea salt caramel. And oh my gosh, I took it over to some of my family's house, social distancing on Sunday, and they could not believe how good it was. And these are people that don't even really love caramel that much, but they were just like, wow, this is so amazing. And, you know, I had people that made it and didn't want to put in the bourbon, or they wanted to put in another dark liquor. And I also had people that, you know, wanted to make it, but, you know, didn't get to make it yet. But it's on my Instagram, it's on my website. So people have gone back and made it. People put it with cookies. I mean, people made all kind of things with it. And I just love it. It's making people so happy.
I wish I was eating it right now. Maya, thank you so much for joining us again. It's been a lot of fun.
This is so much fun. Thank you.
Maya Warren is an ice cream scientist. She received her PhD in food science at UW-Madison. She joined us on this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about how to make no-churn ice cream at home without fancy equipment. You can find a few of the recipes she shared with us online over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Find out how to do it yourself at home. Then bring me some. Coming up after the news, a new report shows that decisions made in Milwaukee's April election cut turnout for all voters, and African Americans were particularly affected. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, already hard-hit Milwaukee businesses are facing another blow. The DNC is scaling back its convention, which would have brought thousands of visitors to the city. A business reporter joins the show with reactions from local restaurants, hotels, and more. First, a new study finds that many voters stayed home from the polls in Milwaukee in April's election. Milwaukee was and is the epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak in Wisconsin, and only a handful of polling places were open for in-person voting. According to the study, African-American voters were the hardest hit. Dee Hall is managing editor of Wisconsin Watch and is reporting on the study. She recently talked to WPR host Keely Baltina.
Let's start with the numbers here. What does this study show about overall voting behavior in Milwaukee?
So it looked at a combination of factors. Two things. One, closing voting locations. Milwaukee went from 182 polling places to 5. And then this is a moment where the coronavirus pandemic was raging, especially in Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, and there was a lot of fear around that. And so the study looked at what was the effect on Black voters who were also more likely to be affected by the coronavirus pandemic, and non-Black voters. So among the Black voters, between the two factors, so they had separate factors for the poll closures, which were had the biggest impact, and then also the fear of COVID-19 or the fact that we're in a pandemic was a smaller effect. But when you add those two effects together, for Black voters, they the researchers at the Brennan Center estimate that the voter turnout was suppressed by 15.9 percentage points. When they looked at non-Black voters, the percentage was an estimated 9.9 percentage points. So that those were the top line findings from the study.
So we know the factors from this study did impact voting, and the Brennan Center for Justice is saying nearly 16% of Black voters did not vote in April in Milwaukee because of the circumstances?
Yes, that's what their estimate is. And they did a pretty sophisticated, I'd say very sophisticated, because I certainly could never duplicate this. But what they did was they did a matching of individual Milwaukee voters in the city with other Milwaukee County and voters in Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties, the so-called Wow counties, the conservative suburbs of Milwaukee, and then Racine County. So they matched them demographically and politically, and they controlled for a variety of factors and found, okay, if they were in Milwaukee, if these Black voters or these non-Black voters were in the city of Milwaukee, you know, what was their rate of voting versus the rate for other people? There was a lot of geographic matching there too, which I didn't get into in the story because it's just very complicated. But in the end, you know, they found that that was a very significant drop in voter participation, which they credit with both the severe reduction in polling places as well as the fact of the COVID-19 crisis.
How do you respond to people who might assume that this would just be normal, that people just don't always show up at the polls and that's how it works?
Well, that's one thing they did match is they looked at their voting behavior, too. You know, they were choosing people who had voted the last couple of elections or not voted the last couple of elections, and compared those folks. So they were it's too complicated to go into even in my story, but they did account for all as many factors as they could think of to just make it clear that they were isolating out the effects of this polling consolidation, poll place consolidation primarily, and then secondarily the pandemic. And I will say that they did cite numerous previous studies that confirm that when you move a polling place, especially if you put it farther away, that depresses, that has a certifiable effect on voter turnout. And so that happened in Milwaukee on a grand scale. You know, they went from 182 polling places to 5. Now, I did speak with Neil Albrecht, and he is the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission. And he said essentially that he was, you know, the commission was forced into that decision because there were only 300 of the 2,200 normal election staff. These are folks who work just for that day, you know, and possibly later for recounts and such. But these are folks who come in to work the election day, work the polls. Normally they have 2,200 people to choose from. It was reduced to 300. And so the city decided that they had to do something drastic because in-person voting was, you know, they were ordered to go ahead with the election as scheduled. There were last minute attempts, as probably everyone will remember, to delay the election or to make it primarily a mail-in ballot election, but those were rejected and the election by the courts, and the election went forward as it was planned.
We're talking with Dee Hall of Wisconsin Watch, and we're discussing the results of a study from the Brennan Center for Justice that shows Milwaukee voters were disenfranchised in April's elections, especially Black voters. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Dee, in April, you know, you just mentioned the vote by mail. We saw that frenzied push for absentee ballots, voting by mail, or being able to drop off your ballot at the clerk's office, not have to wait in line to in-person vote. But not everyone who requested a ballot got one. Is that a concern in November, especially in Milwaukee?
Well, I think it's a concern all over the state. But yes, Milwaukee has the highest volume, being the largest city. It's been well documented that there were many people, probably thousands, who asked for ballots. And because we had this just record-breaking demand for absentee ballots, it was the demand for, I think it was over, well, it's definitely over 1 million. 1.1 million were actually cast absentee ballots, which is four times the normal amount. And So this is the problem, is that the clerks who, and these elections are run locally by the town clerk or the village clerk, the city clerk, they were not ready for this. They're not staffed up for something like this. And casting absentee ballots is a very cumbersome on both sides, both on the part of the voter as well as on the part of the clerk's office. And so there is a concern that with this expected surge, and we do expect another surge in absentee balloting because there is no sign that this pandemic is ending anytime soon, that there may be, again, some more of these problems. And among the problems that we found and we wrote about, and I know WPR and others did too, is the a failure by the U.S. Postal Service to deliver some of these ballots, either from the clerk's offices to the voters or from the voters back to the polling place or back to the municipalities in time to be counted. So there were a lot of gaps and failures there. Right now, what's happening is the state of Wisconsin, the Elections Commission, has decided to send absentee ballot applications to 2.7 million registered voters, with the idea that you will get these people in place much sooner, hopefully, not trying to deal with last minute requests, but really take a proactive stance to say, okay, if you really think you're going to vote absentee in November, here's the application. Please fill it out. Well, that'll give clerks more time to get the ballots to the voters.
And yet you note that minority voters are less likely to vote absentee. Is that a matter of simply not requesting absentee ballots, or do we have further issues when it comes to people of color and voting by mail?
This has been studied by researchers, and what they found is that there just is not a tradition in states like Wisconsin of, well, first of absentee balloting to begin with, and then beyond that, in this state and others, that people of color tend to take this step. There are places where, in Wisconsin's one of them, where the in-person voting is sort of the tradition. It's a thing that people do. They go to the polls. They plan for it. What these researchers have found is that people of color tend to take advantage of that option less often than others, also young people and some other demographics. But when they do participate, young people and people of color tend to have their ballots rejected at a much higher rate for a variety of reasons. And the reasons vary on the state. You know, some states have something called signature matching, where they try to match the signature on your registration with the signature on your absentee ballot. We don't have that. But we do have a witness requirement, which is hard for some people to comply with during a pandemic. If you're sheltering in place by yourself, it is difficult for you to get a witness to your ballot. And the State Elections Commission has some pretty interesting methods, suggestions for how to do that without having any physical contact with the witness of your ballot. But it's a more complicated process. And the simplest thing is just to go, okay, it's Tuesday, it's election day. Here's my polling place, same one I always go to, just go. And, you know, the process for the most part during a non-pandemic time is pretty straightforward, you know, and doesn't take a lot of time. So there's just not a history in our state of doing a lot of absentee balloting, but I think that's changing this year.
In broad strokes, then, what could this finding indicate about November's election?
Well, they warned that, you know, that the voters will not here and elsewhere are not going to seamlessly transition to vote by mail, and that that clerks, municipalities should think very strongly about, you know, polling place closures, because that will come at the expense of turnout. So, and you know, what they also found, they took a look at this as well, these researchers from the Brennan Center also looked at the issue of, you know, whether the surge in absentee balloting supplanted the lack of in-person turnout. And they found that it does not fully do that. So that's the other issue, too, is it's not going to be a one-for-one trade. There are some people who are going to say, I don't want to go out to the polls on Tuesday, so I'm not going to vote. And then there will be others who may try to navigate the absentee balloting process. Hopefully, most of them will be successful. But some percentage will not be, because it's a new process for many, many Wisconsin voters.
Dee, thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
Dee Hall is managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. She talked with WPR host Keely Boltina about a study from the Brennan Center for Justice. That study finds that voter turnout was reduced in Milwaukee in April elections because of limited polling sites and other problems. Black voters saw a particularly big impact. You can read a full story on our website. There's a link at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk to a business reporter about how Milwaukee's hospitality industry is reacting to news that the Democratic National Convention will be greatly scaled back because of the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the federal government has given out billions of dollars worth of contracts during the pandemic for things like protective equipment and testing supplies. But some of that money has gone to brand new companies that have never made medical equipment before. We'll talk with an investigative reporter about what he and his colleagues have found. Now, leaders with the Democratic Party announced this week that their 2020 national convention will be scaled back considerably because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Milwaukee will still host the nominating event, but the DNC has asked a majority of delegates to join remotely, and scheduled party events around the city have been canceled. The news strikes a blow to businesses throughout the Milwaukee area that were counting on an influx of out-of-towners and that have already been hurt by the novel coronavirus outbreak. Tom Dakin is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and MJS Online. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us a before and after from what we know. Tom, what was the expectation of this big convention? What is the reality looking like now?
Well, the expectation when it was announced in 2019 was 50,000, that's 5-0, 50,000 visitors, creating an economic impact of $200 million. With Wednesday's announcement, we haven't heard a figure yet as to how many people the DNC expects to come for the mostly virtual meeting in August, but I don't think it's going to be very big, to put it kindly. It's certainly not going to rank among, say, the normally large meetings that we have every year, the Northwestern Mutual annual meeting, for example. It's going to be nowhere near what that would normally be, and that, by the way, also has been canceled. It's going to end up being kind of like a middling-type meeting in terms of economic impact.
You talked to area business owners who had been hoping for a big surge in business from this convention. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, honestly, just sort of resignation. I mean, nobody's terribly surprised by this. We knew for some time, based on all the signals coming from the DNC, that it was going to be scaled back. We just didn't know to what extent. The folks that I talked to, for example, Tim Dixon, who operates the Iron Horse Hotel, which is a luxury hotel just south of downtown, essentially said, you know, at this point, we'll take any business we can get. Tim reopened his hotel after about 11-week shutdown. He reopened in early June. He would normally be full this time of year from Memorial Day to Labor Day virtually every night. He's running about a 20% occupancy rate. And I'm sure he's not alone in that. Marcus Hotels, you're probably familiar with them. That company operates three large high-end hotels in downtown Milwaukee. They did reopen the Pfister about 2 weeks ago. But their Hilton Milwaukee City Center downtown and the St. Kate Hotel of the Arts both remain closed. So I'm sure they've seen a big drop off in business. And it's just been very, very hard on the travel industry because of COVID-19.
Right. The DNC is just yet another thing. You mentioned it's not the only event that would usually happen in the Milwaukee area this time of year. There's a lot of that going on, I imagine.
Well, let's count them. No Summerfest, no Irish Fest, no German Fest, no Polish Fest, et cetera. We're going to get Major League Baseball now, it looks like, but that's, of course, being greatly reduced. No Northwestern Mutual annual meeting, no Wisconsin State Fair. God, you know, we were even hoping to have the Bucks in the NBA Finals, which would result in games being played in Milwaukee if I serve form in June. Now that's not happening. So, yeah, it's been pretty bleak if you own a hotel and a restaurant and a bar.
Yeah, let's talk about those restaurants and bars. That's another big part of the story. And I understand, I think some restaurant owners are trying to scale up and other venue owners trying to scale up to get ready for this DNC influx.
Well, there certainly was talk of that, like I said, starting in 2019 up through when the coronavirus began hitting. And I think there was a gradual realization that came in that we weren't going to have a DNC anywhere near along the lines of what we had originally planned, if we would have one at all, frankly. Bear in mind, Charlotte, North Carolina isn't getting anything given what's happening there. When you say scale up, I mean, certainly they're making provisions to hire extra employees. That's not happening now. Quite honestly, the restaurants in Milwaukee have only now just begun to open in the last couple of weeks once the local city order gave them the go-ahead to do that. And they're now just trying to figure out how to get more outdoor dining space, because that's what people feel comfortable doing. And that's falls in line with CDC guidelines as to what's safer in terms of dining. So we're now trying to figure out, or I should say the restaurants now are trying to figure out how to expand on the sidewalks and even into some closed city streets that might help accommodate those additional outdoor dining spots.
Talking to Tom Dakin, business reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and MJS Online, looking at the impact of a big scaling back of the Democratic National Convention on businesses in Milwaukee and the surrounding area. Just the latest bit of bad news to follow a lot of damage from the COVID-19 pandemic already. Tom, are we at a place where some of these hotels, restaurants aren't going to make it out of this?
Well, we've had a few restaurants that have already said they're permanently closed, that they're not going to reopen, even now that they can reopen. Hotels haven't heard of any that have gone quite to that drastic length, but honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if we have a few that fall into some very difficult financial travails. Now, whether that means they actually shut down or not permanently, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if you have some hotel operators who have to restructure their debt, perhaps under Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. That just simply wouldn't surprise me at this point.
What have you heard from local leaders, chambers of commerce, that kind of thing, and how they're trying to help businesses get through this time?
Well, like in a lot of communities, there have been efforts to put together local grant programs. We have some of that here through the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. That's our chamber of commerce in this area. And then, of course, there were the PPP loans available from the federal government that a lot of small businesses took advantage, as well as hotel operators, including larger hotel operators. When Congress was creating the PPP program, the hotel industry successfully lobbied to get a provision allowing it to obtain those loans, even if they weren't, quote unquote, small businesses. And the industry argued they should get that because of the catastrophic effects on travel from COVID-19. And Marcus Hotels is one of the larger companies that's taken advantage of that. There have been others as well. So there are things out there for them to obtain to try and get through this. Marcus, in addition to that, was able to obtain a large line of credit from some commercial lenders as well.
How about infrastructure changes, Tom? I think I had seen that Mitchell Field, the airport there, was going to be trying to get ready for the big influx of passengers with the DNC. Is there anything else like that that there might already be some investment on the ground that isn't going to come to fruition now?
Well, we did have certain street projects that were being, I think, expedited, but I wouldn't say they were being done specifically for the DNC. Okay. I think things that were already on schedule that the sense was, well, let's hurry up and get them done now before 50,000 people come to town. Those would be done in either course. I do know that there were some tentative steps by some of the wireless carriers to upgrade their infrastructure. They at the very least, they pulled the construction permits to do that. But my recollection was that was happening right before COVID-19 hit, and I'm not sure that they have now gone forward on most of those plans, given everything that's happened.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Tom, what are you watching for when it comes to the economic impact of this much reduced Democratic National Convention this summer?
Well, we're seeking, my colleagues and I are trying to seek revised estimates as to how many people they expect to get and what the impact will be. And by the way, the original economic impact, 200 million out of 50,000 visitors, your viewers who are right now, I should say your listeners who are right now doing the math in their heads, will say, gee, that's $4,000 per person. To answer your next question, yeah, that's probably puffed up. I think every economic impact industry ever done since the beginning of mankind has taken multiplier effects to a, shall we say, liberal degree.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Tom Dakin. He's a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and MJS Online. He joined us on the show today to talk about how a much scaled back Democratic National Convention this summer will impact Milwaukee businesses already hit hard by the COVID-19 outbreak. We heard from some restaurant owners over the last few weeks. Are you one of the businesses affected by this? Send us a note. Email ideas@WPR.org. Wisconsin has had some decent thunderstorms this season, including today in parts of the state. And we've all probably seen some pretty impressive lightning bolts and flashes at one time or another in our lives, but probably nothing like this. Yesterday, the World Meteorological Organization confirmed some record-setting lightning flashes. Actually, they call them mega flashes. As reported in the Washington Post, the organization says the largest recorded burst of lightning was spotted on October 31st, 2018 in Brazil. The spider web of lightning spanned about 440 miles. It was spotted in Argentina, Brazil, and out over the Atlantic Ocean. For a little perspective, 440 miles can drive you from Kenosha to Superior, with a little mileage left for a frozen custard detour along the way. That's the record for observed length. There's also a new record for the longest duration of a lightning flash, 16.73 seconds. That was Argentina in March of 2019. Apparently, there are some weather conditions in South America that are ripe for mega flashes. By the way, the dates of these flashes are pretty recent. That doesn't mean lightning is getting worse. We're just getting better at measuring it. It's lightning news you can use. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.